And now we're going to go to more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste.
Hey, thank you so much for calling, and thank all of you who are members and are considering membership here on KBOO-FM. Joining us this morning is Dave Zirin, who is the author of several books and also is in town. He'll be at Powell's this evening at 7:30 to talk about his latest book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love.
And by Powell's, we want to make sure you know we're talking about the Powell's downtown, the one on East Burnside. So make sure you show up 7:30.
West Burnside.
West Burnside. Thank you much. You can tell I was an East Portlander. Mm-hmm. I guess it's still in the blood. Anyway, welcome, Dave. You can catch him. He's the host of Edge of Sports Radio Show. He's been a guest before here on More Talk Radio when we've interviewed him behind Terror Dome and What's My Name, Fool? And this is your opportunity to call and talk to him about bad sports, how owners are ruining the games we love. And I wanted to preface the show by talking about, I tried to pull Cecil out of his shell about his sports betrayal story. And he acts like he doesn't remember because, you know, he's a New Yorker and we heard all about it about two shows ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. And see, and I grew up in St. Louis and we used to have the St. Louis Cardinals for football and the St. Louis Cardinals for baseball. And then in 87, at the very end of the year, as a matter of fact, I think it was in December for the last game, we lost our football Cardinals, the Cardiac Cards. And the owner of the team was so concerned about showing up in front of some disgruntled fans that he hid. He couldn't be found. And it was Bill Bidwell. When you have a strong fan base like that, people who support, who come to love the team, whose roots are intertwined with the team, much like the New Yorkers, especially the one who is here with me but very silent. I think he's having a quiet moment of, you know, melancholy behind his team. You have a different fabric to life. You have a richness in life. You have an opportunity for young kids and old folks and older folks alike to live with the players, to glorify in the sport, to enjoy the pure pursuit of athletics. Now, fast forward to days now, and it's not the same. It's turned into a Wall Street activity, more all about money, more about how much more money I can get, and all about me as the owner and what I can get. And you say, well, Celeste, surely you don't mean that. Well, let's just take a look. How many of you are getting an affordable hot dog or beverage? How many of you are wondering when your next bond measure is going to pit a school up against a sports stadium? Those are just two of the examples in which we find that sports has changed and owners have changed, and we, the fan, are being shortchanged. Welcome, Dave.
Hey, great to be here. Always a pleasure to be on Kaboo. Now, I did. You just raised some wonderful points in which to kick off a discussion about this. I mean, this idea that sports teams can be moved so easily is something that's so uniquely American that if people should ponder that for a second. Like, in the book, I take the moment to do a chapter about European soccer, particularly the team Liverpool, mm-hmm. which has actually been in the news a lot recently because they just did a sale. And in Europe, the conception is this. It's the fans' team, but the owner is important because the owner is there to safeguard the team. The owner is there to be the sort of caretaker of the team. The steward mm-hmm. of the team. And if the owner fails in that capacity, the owner will hear about it. There will be pickets. There will be protests. There will be a sense that, wait a minute, you're taking something that's ours and doing something very wrong. The conception in this country is much more passive from a fan perspective. It's the owner's team. They're moving the team. That's terrible. That's awful. But what are you going to do? It's theirs. And one of the things I argue in the book is that we need to change the entire way of thinking about this and start raising the issue that, wait a minute, if these teams are something that we hand down like heirlooms from generation to generation, if these are teams that we feel this incredible moral affection towards, if these are teams that we feel a incredible community connection towards, and frankly, if these are teams that we are subsidizing
yes.
through bond issues, through taxes, through public subsidies, then we actually have a political claim to ownership, a financial claim to ownership, and we need to start saying, you know what, these teams were ours long before they were ever yours, and we're no longer going to do this process which has existed in this country where we socialize the debt of these teams but privatize the profits of these teams.
Speaking of which, in terms of how we view the teams in terms of ownership, you hinted at it in your final comment in terms of subsidizing the teams and these rich owners. Perhaps you can tell us more in terms of perhaps has there been a change in philosophy mm-hmm. in terms of team ownership and in terms of responsibilities?
That's a fantastic question. And Celeste hinted at it a moment ago where she said in her comments that owners have changed. She's absolutely right that owners have changed. But it's not that owners used to be nice people who went up in the trees to save kitty cats and did community service on the weekend and now all of a sudden they're these ruthless, mean billionaires.
It's robber barons.
Yeah, it's not that. Yeah, it's not that their psychology has changed or their minds have changed. It's that the very political economy of sports mm-hmm. has changed dramatically over the last 30 years, and it's frighteningly, I would argue, under discussed because it has warped and distorted professional sports in this country to a pretty profound degree. Let me explain what I mean. About roughly, I chart it back to the early 1990s, actually. So call it 20 years ago, even before 20 years ago. If a team was going to be successful financially, you needed to have butts in the seats, basically. There was the butts in the seats approach. You needed to have fans come in. That means you needed to make sure that a whole section of seats were affordable to working class and middle class fans. That means that you needed to make sure that the games ended at an appropriate hour. That means you needed to make sure that you always had afternoon games on the weekends. You had to make sure that you set up a product that people would buy tickets for. Now, fans have become like scenery. Fans are so down the totem pole when it comes to what actually makes money for a modern professional franchise. It really does boggle the mind. Now, if you're an owner and you want to be successful, if you want to make mega profits, this is what matters. How many public subsidies do you get? Mm-hmm. Which means whether you're a sports fan or not, you're affecting their bottom line because hands are going in your pocket. Second thing, sweetheart cable deal. Do you have a cable deal that gets you in excess, in some places, $400 million extra dollars a year? Third thing, luxury boxes. The mm-hmm. idea that you have these things that ring the stadium, they only really cater to a couple of hundred people, but they make a tremendous amount of money. And then the last thing, and this is particularly true in Major League Baseball, but it exists in other sports as well, revenue sharing, where you have teams like the Yankees who spend a tremendous amount of money on their product, basically write checks to teams like the Pittsburgh Pirates, the Kansas City Royals, as a way to say, well, this is our way of giving them more money because they don't have the cable deals and the stadium infrastructure that the Yankees do. The problem with that, though, and this is something we just found out this year with leaked documents from Major League Baseball, is that while there is a salary cap, there is no salary floor.
Mm-hmm. So
while the Yankees are writing checks for $20 million to the Pittsburgh Pirates, there is no obligation that they spend that money on players. So the New York Yankees shortstop, a gentleman by the name of Derek Jeter, and their third baseman, a gentleman by the name of Alex Rodriguez, as individuals, make more money than the entire Pittsburgh Pirates a team.
Well, can I add one more aspect in there? And those folks who live in Seattle and other cities are familiar. And then we'll go to our callers in our membership break. What about the corporate face? I mean, after all, when I grew up, we had the Cardinals Stadium. It was bad enough it was Busch Stadium, but at least there was a sense of some kind of community roots. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's Quest or it's Safeco or it's, I don't know, Walmart. City Field. And we mean CITI, by the way.
Yeah,
so there's the corporate
Mets.
Aspect of it.
And Dave will be at Powell City of Books this evening at 7:30 p.m., That's 1005 West Burnside. He'll talk about his latest book, Bad Sports, and he invites you to be a part of that conversation this evening at Powell City of Books, 7:30 p.m. Dave, as we began our conversation and you mentioned in terms of ownership of teams, I thought it might be interesting to our listeners if we talk about Seattle and maybe Portland in terms of team ownership. The Seattle Supersonics was in Seattle for a long, long time.
40 years.
And now they're Oklahoma.
The Oklahoma City Thunder.
Thunder. Yeah. Mm. Why did that happen?
Oh, it happened because of a theft, because of a gentleman like named Clay Bennett, who I would argue belongs in prison. Mm. He was a person who was from Oklahoma City. He made his money the old-fashioned way. He married into it. Mm-hmm. And he married into the wealthiest family in Oklahoma City, a family known as the Gaylord family. And if you go down Oklahoma City, that's the name of the stadium where the Oklahoma Sooners, the OU team plays, the college team. It's named one of the main thoroughfares in the wealthy, exclusive, restricted suburb where they live is nicknamed in Oklahoma City Gaylordia. Just to give you, and the Gay, their media family, mm-hmm. the Gaylords. And interestingly enough, Clay Bennett has spent a lot of his life, along with his partner Aubrey McClendon, funding anti-gay referendums in states around the country. And I don't know if that has anything to do with his wife's family's name being named Gaylord. I don't know if he has some insecurity issues or what have you, but he's a professional homophobe. And Clay Bennett, he came up to Seattle. He bought the team. He said all these things about the basketball tradition of Seattle, about the history of Seattle, about how much he understood that the team meant to the city. But we now know that that was all a lie, mm-hmm. that it was all an absolute lie. That he had already began to spend money and lay the groundwork to move the team to Oklahoma City. Mm. And these were things that people were saying at the time. And also, we now know that he was sending even emails about how they were going to get this done and abscond with the team and take it and move it down to Oklahoma City. And it's a very ugly scenario because anybody who's been to Seattle knows that a couple of things. First of all, great basketball tradition. People like Slick Watts, Dennis Johnson, Jack Sikma, Gus Williams, Gary Payton, Sean Kemp. I mean, a terrific basketball tradition in that town. The second thing, though, that people know is that that town had been held up for stadium funding for the Seattle Mariners and the Seattle Seahawks. And so Clay Bennett knew just what button to push. Even though the team played in Key Arena, which is still a very functioning,
viable arena.
Clay Bennett said, well, I want $300 million for a new basketball arena. Mm. Hand me $300 million. And people were just like, no, we're not going to do that. And so David Stern, the commissioner, Howard Schultz, the founder of Starbucks, or he wasn't the founder actually, but the owner of Starbucks, somebody who actually also deserves serious contempt for selling the team to Clay Bennett in the first place, when everybody was saying, don't do it, he'll move this team, don't do it. All of them then conspire just to get the team out of there as soon as possible. And one of the things that really upsets me about this whole story is the way the terms of the debate were set up.
Yes.
Either you give us a new stadium or we leave. Mm-hmm. And so then if you're on the other side of that and you don't like being held up by corporate bandits, your response is to say, well, then leave because we're not going to give you the new stadium. One of the things that I'm arguing with this book is that we need to actually change that discussion and say, wait a minute. Your name is Clay Bennett. You've spent less time in Seattle than the sun. You have no business coming to us like this. And we are going to claim eminent domain on this team, and we'll seize it. We'll seize it as a state property.
Mm. Now, you know, that's an interesting concept because I'm still reeling. I never could quite understand how an owner could hold any municipality a hostage by demanding that they play a team since, well, gee, we pay for the tickets, mm-hmm. you know, and you're already squeezing extra money because you're trying to get the media, as you aptly mentioned, on board. So why do I need to, like, pay in my taxes for your stadium? I'm not understanding that because mm-hmm. you're making money. Are you giving me some money back? Are you giving the school some money? Or are you making sure that our chubby little kids have athletic equipment?
Not at all.
No.
Actually, in many places, you see a direct connection, a causal connection with the funding of stadiums and the cutting of physical education programs. I was just up in Vancouver before the Olympics, the Winter Games there. And it was like in the newspaper as two separate articles. An article about how Vancouver and British Columbia were going into tremendous debt to pay for the Winter Games. Yeah. And then a concurrent article. No, not concurrent. I'm sorry. A totally separate article talking about how the physical education was being cut in Vancouver schools. And as if one yes. has nothing to do with the other. And of course they have something to do with the other. So it's like there's this old line by Ralph Nader who said, you better turn on to politics or politics are going to turn on you. It's like people better turn on to sports. Mm. And now sport, whether you consider yourself a sports fan or not, and I absolutely consider myself a sports fan, and my sense of outrage comes from this place of saying you're taking something that's beautiful, that I love, that I think can lead to community cohesion, that can lead to good times, fun, exercise, health, all the rest of it, and using it as a neoliberal Trojan horse to get into our cities and to rob us blind. So, but whether you come from that perspective like me or you come from the perspective of saying sports, blech, that's a wholly owned subsidiary of Glenn Beck Incorporated or whatever. You know, people have all kinds of come to this from different angles. People got to turn on to the way, just objectively, that sports is being used to rob our cities.
And you mentioned how sports is being used to rob our cities. I think some of us have a fantasy type vision of sports as being pure and honest. And what you do very well is talk about the connection between sports and sports ownership in this country and right wing politics.
Yeah, it's a big part of the book. And I frankly could care less whether sports owners are to the right of Genghis Khan, which most of them are. And you can actually – you can track this stuff through political giving and the causes they give to. And I do it in the book. And it's very, very, very right-wing breed of cat in the owner's box. Mm-hmm. I could care less about that. That's their business if they want to have those kinds of politics. What I do care about is how often some of these very far right-wing organizations, not to mention the Republican Party itself, gets underwritten mm-hmm. by donations from sports owners. Sports owners who get public subsidies for their stadiums.
So you mean like the fan who buys a ticket to see the Magic play and doesn't realize that they're supporting Blackwater operations?
Exactly, things like that. Yeah. The owner of the Orlando Magic, I have a whole chapter on him in the book. His name is Dick DeVos, founder of Amway. He's a multi-billionaire. And honestly, if people know what Amway products are, you got to sell a lot of lousy hand lotion to make over $1 billion. So that's not where his money's coming from. I mean, he's got over $1 billion in public subsidies going into this new Orlando fantasy arena out there. And Dick DeVos is also somebody, I mean, he makes Rush Limbaugh look like Chomsky. I mean, his politics are crazy right-wing. He underwrites Focus on the Family, Family Research Council, all the organizations out of Colorado Springs. That I chart them in the book. It's a scary group. But to go to your point, and I want to just jump to it real quick, is Dick DeVos made sure that his son, Dick Jr., married into the Prince family, which was another billionaire family based out of Michigan. Mm-hmm. So you're talking like it's almost like a feudal situation where two royal families couple.
Couple, right.
Yep. You know, people don't get married. Rich folk don't get married like you and me get married. You know, it's like they make sure they're building empire to make this marriage last.
Right,
it's the gift
right.
that keeps on giving.
Yes.
And so they had Dick Jr. marry the daughter of a gentleman named Edgar Prince. Her name's Betsy Prince. Betsy Prince's brother, Edgar's son, is named Eric Prince. Eric Prince is the former Navy SEAL who founded Blackwater. And Blackwater got over $700 million during the 2000 decade when George W. Bush was president in government contracts. Now, who was the number one donator to George W. Bush's presidency and campaign during those 8 years? Dick DeVos.
Connect the dots. We're speaking with Dave Zirin, author of Bad Sports. He'll speak this evening at Powell City Books at 7:30 p.m. We have a couple of callers online. Let's go to our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Michael, you're on the air. Hello? Okay, well, let's see. We're getting a signal from the engineer. Okay, let's try our next caller then. Good morning. You're on the air. Okay, well, we're not seeing anything from our engineer here.
Well,
so,
but there's more than enough for us to
talk about.
There's much for us to talk about. You know, let me jump in here really quick. Well, one of the things that I want to do is I want to touch back on what you were talking about, Cecil, about the purity of sports. Cecil and I were having a discussion last night, and we were talking about the trickle-down effect, if you will, of corporate professional sports and the effect it's having on college sports and the tainting that it's even having on sports at the kids' level. And one of the reasons I want to bring this up is people think of sports as being a separate realm over there that people participate in. You know, it's like you said, whether you are a sports fan or not. I maintain that sports is a direct reflection of our economy, our sociology, and our psychology. How are these corporatizing and robber baron effects trickling down and affecting college ball? And I'm especially looking at the recent developments with Reggie Bush giving back the Heisman Trophy and being a scapegoat, more or less. Mm-hmm. It's not to say he didn't have his own culpability in this. But when you look at the whole environment, Cecil brought up the good point. Well, it's kind of like you have to sell your soul to play anywhere. There's no such thing as the pure sport anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it goes even deep. We can talk about college ball. I mean, oh, I'm sorry. What was that, Cecil?
No, I was saying, you know, in terms of going down to high school and little league levels, in terms of
it goes,
you know,
deeper
Nike
than that.
And all
I mean, this is something I spend a great deal of time talking about on my radio show and writing about, is this whole idea of the professionalization of youth sports. Mm-hmm. And it's something of an obsession for me because, you know, I'm a big believer that sports is kind of like fire, and that you can use fire to make a meal, and that's a good thing. Keep yourself warm, or you could use fire and it can burn your house down. And far too often today, sports is used in that kind of destructive way, especially relative to young people. And yeah, I used to, this is my roots. I taught third grade in my early 20s. I taught for 4 years. And one of the things that just disgusted me and removed my mind from public education was seeing the physical education programs at my school get cut, while at the same time, seemingly the next week, although it was probably like a month later, but it felt like really closed in, a bunch of the boys, and it was just boys, coming into the classroom wearing these new jerseys and having new cleats. And these were poor kids. Mm-hmm. And there was largely El Salvadoran school, you know, people really into soccer culturally. And they came in and they were like, Mr. Z, check it out, check it out. I got new cleats, new shirt. And I was like, how did you afford that? And they said, oh, this traveling sports team came by, and now they're part of like this traveling squad because they're good. And so I was just like, damn, already this message is being sent to these 8-9-year-old kids that there's some who get to play because they're good, and the rest of them just get to watch and cheer and are doomed to a life of probably childhood obesity or juvenile diabetes or what have you. And so this idea that sports becomes professionalized at such a young age is really, really disgusting to me. And this is something that, once again, goes to these choices. Like Washington, D.C., they built $1 billion for a publicly funded baseball stadium. A news story that was happening at the same time is they had to default on their Little League dues. So the Washington, D.C. was cut out of the Little League because they couldn't pay for their Little League dues when they've got $1 billion to pay for a stadium for the pros. There's something really, really off about this. And I think future generations will, frankly, judge us very harshly, because it shows a system of priorities that's entirely out of whack.
And you are listening to our interview with Dave Zirin, author of Bad Sports, who will speak this evening at Powell City of Books at 7:30 p.m. That's at 1005 West Burnside. And we have a couple of callers online.
Before we go, I just thought it was very interesting what we were talking about off mic. Just give the listeners a sense of that. Like, literally in the same sentence, we were all agreeing that so much of sports today is about pacification and bread and circuses. Mm-hmm. And then, as it, in finishing the thought, you were talking about how much you loved watching the baseball game last night. Celeste was talking about how much she was like the drama of Brett Favre holding his elbow. Good thing it was just his elbow.
Thank God. And,
but it's just like there is that aspect, though, that there's a part of sports that still speaks to the better angels of our nature, while at the same time it's used so ruthlessly to put us in check. We got to recognize that it's both.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Well, let's try our callers again. Thank you for waiting. Good morning, Michael.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thanks for calling back.
I just want to say that he's overlooking a lot of things. First of all, there's always been things wrong with the sports. Whenever you have a semi-literate ball player making more money than engineers and doctors and the president of the United States, something is wrong with sports. Also, let's talk about Nike, how Nike became this global entity basically off of poor black athletes. And I bet if you went out to Nike campus today, you might be lucky to find five black people working out there. So they don't give back. I think anybody black that go out and apply for a job at Nike ought to get hired. Also, college. College is a plantation, college sports, where those athletes make millions and millions of dollars for the owners, but yet they don't get paid a dime. So there's always been something wrong with sports.
Well, you brought up something interesting about the college plantation. That was one of the reasons why I brought up Reggie Bush, because he made bad choices. You know, he took some of the gifts, but that is a system that, that basically says if you want to play ball, you're going to have to swim in the dirty water, and of course you're going to drink some.
Well, you know, that's true. So, like I said, there's always been something wrong with sports, and it just didn't start. It's really, like I say, there's something wrong when you got semi-literate ball players making that kind of money. Anyway, that's all I got to say.
Well, I would come back on, Michael, you were on point with a lot of what you said. The one thing, though, that I would want to come back on is the idea about blaming, or it seems like throwing blame or trying to put the focus on the, as you put it, semi-literate ball players. I mean, first of all, not all of them are semi-literate. I mean, you talk to a lot of these guys, and I highlight them. A lot of them are very socially conscious, see themselves in the tradition of people like Muhammad Ali, Billie Jean King, Bill Russell.
John Carlos,
Tommy Smith. And that's something that should be acknowledged, because we can't be stereotyping athletes in that way. The second thing that I would point out, though, as well, is that, look, we're about to head to some serious labor issues, particularly in the NFL and the NBA, where players are going to be locked out. It's going to be the biggest national story out there right now. And a lot of people are going to write it off as saying, well, who cares? It's billionaires versus millionaires. Mm-hmm. And I would make the case that that's a very lazy formulation. And while I certainly agree that it says something sick that we live in a society where teachers make so little and professional athletes make so much more, you got to recognize that the business of sports is huge. And if players made less money, it wouldn't mean lower ticket prices. It wouldn't mean the end of public subsidizing of stadiums at all. It would just mean that the owners would be wealthier, because they have their financial plan, which is completely independent of player salaries. And players only make the salaries they do because they have unions that fight for a bigger piece of that pie. Mm-hmm. Now, we can be completely disgusted with how that pie gets baked, but that's on the owner's box. Mm-hmm. That's not on the players. I mean, you got to remember, a typical NFL player only plays 3.5 years, and it's not much longer for baseball or the NBA. So we can't talk about them as if they're somehow this equal entity to people who are owners for decades mm-hmm. and are stewards of their sport.
Mm-hmm. You know, you brought up the point. You said it's a feudal system. So if it's a feudal system, that means they're the overlord.
Yeah.
They are. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, caller.
Hello? Caller, it's you. Hello.
Hello.
Turn down your radio.
Okay. I might be a little off topic, but when somebody changes their skin to another color, Sammy Sosa did. I don't understand that.
Okay. That's still a question worth asking.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah.
People might have seen that Sammy Sosa did this skin lightening treatment mm-hmm. and looking just all kinds of freaky deaky when he was done with it.
Self-hate?
Yeah, though, well, certainly. I mean, this, and I'll try to make a sports connection to this, in that right now, Major League Baseball, people might know, is profoundly less African-American than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
going from roughly a quarter of all players being African-American to being now roughly around 8%. I mean, that's a huge drop. And at the same time, you've seen a huge explosion of players from Latin America. Now 27.7% of players are born in Latin America, the overwhelming majority of that 27.7% from where Sammy Sosa is from, the Dominican Republic.
Right.
The Dominican Republic
has a lot of brown people.
Right.
Yeah, brown and black people, mm-hmm. people of African descent. And there is an aspect where what these kids put themselves through to get in the baseball academies down there, the poverty rate in the DR is at over 60% of the country. And Sammy Sosa once said this quote where he said, look, you either make those baseball academies when you're 15, or you go into crime, or you work in the shoe factory, or you join the army.
Mm-hmm.
And those are your choices. And so it's hard, and given that there's next to no education at these baseball academies that these kids are just clawing to get into, they get signed for $2,000. 99% of them don't make it to the pros. Mm-hmm. See the movie Sugar if you get the chance. It does
okay.
a very good job of talking about this. And there's no space in that to develop any kind of knowledge of self or knowledge of history, because think about your own life when you learned. I assume you're a socially conscious person because you listen to KBOO.
Yeah.
So it's like, think about your own life, about when you actually learned a sense of who you are. I mean, for most of us, it's in that age between, say, 15 and 22 when we do that, usually because we get a good teacher or someone hands us a book. For a lot of us, it was Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Mm-hmm. For me, as a Caucasian, it was the autobiography of Malcolm X, and reading that and blowing my mind when I was 18. Think about if instead of that, from ages 15 to 22, you're playing baseball 24 hours a day, hoping and praying that you get a chance to get off this island
right.
that's immiserated in poverty. That, to me, is the roots of how Sammy Sosa ends up looking like Jack Nicholson in the Batman movie, which is a tragedy. But thank you. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we have a couple of callers online. Let's try to get those in before the end of the hour.
Yes.
Good morning, caller. Thank you for waiting.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello, it's you.
It's me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yes, support KBOO. It's the only place I get to say anything. But anyway, yes, our country is owned by corporations. The world's owned by corporations, and we're going to do war forever. And you folks and everybody else expected democracy.
Okay. I think that was a pithy comment. I don't even know how to follow that.
Yes, filled with all kinds of pith.
Okay,
that was a great comment. We'll go to the next
caller. Pith and vinegar.
Yep, there you go.
Pith and vinegar. Next caller, thank you for waiting.
Yeah, hi, this is John. I have a question about team play.
Mm-hmm. Now,
when you talk about youth sports, you know, team play and being unselfish and working together for a goal, it's really like community work together.
Yes, it is.
But then when you get into the idea of corporate team play, all of a sudden this idea of, you know, not being a whistleblower, going along with the corporate line, not being a whiner, and so on and so forth comes in. I'm just curious to ask your guest, to what extent does he feel that children's youth sports have been co-opted to create future good corporate team players?
Oh, I mean, I think it's without question. I mean, I say this as someone who's a father. I've seen the way it exists. And unfortunately, it's okay. I think he's still listening. Unfortunately, the sort of the thin line, if you will, is really about the parents and the coaches of an individual team. I've seen it time and again. Mm-hmm. You get a coach who actually cares about all the kids playing, about kids exercising, having a good time. Then you have a wonderful experience for a child. If you get a coach who's living out their Vince Lombardi fantasy, then you have a problem. And then you get the issue of the parents. Are parents going to support a coach who, frankly, is much more about the journey than the destination? Mm. You know, the final score, so what? You know, let's try to actually have some fun and do something together and make some memories together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you have to defend that coach against parents. Other times, and I've had this experience too, you got to organize the parents against a coach.
Mm.
I had this coach run out onto the court, 6-year-old soccer, and run out and make this little girl cry right in the middle of the field. And I said, you know, in my head, I was like, I want to go out there and punch that dude out, but then, you know, end up on YouTube or something.
Yes, unfortunately.
So instead, it's like you actually have to, first of all, calm down when you see something that terrible, get the other parents together and say, we need to go as one and say that's utterly inappropriate. And that's what we did. We walked over 20 deep to this guy, and we're like, that never happens again, or you're out of here. That's consider it a one-strike warning. And he's been on point since then. And he apologized and said, oh, I got too into it and whatever. And we're just like, well, I don't care. That's your chance. Go for it. We're glad you're volunteering to do it. Nobody's getting paid here. And it's not even like college where people should be getting paid.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And so let's just try to do this right.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Dave Zirin, who will be at Powell's City of Books
City
this
of Books.
Evening. He is the author of Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love.
Mm-hmm. He's also the author of What's My Name, Fool? And Welcome to the Terror Dome. And you get a chance to also listen to him. He'll be on his radio show, Edge of Sports Radio. So,
available for free on iTunes.
That's right.
Check it out.
And you know what? Listen to Dave, because he breaks down sports in a way that makes you remember why you like the games you love. There it is. So stay tuned here, because this is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. And I still want to send a plea out to everybody who has not become a member yet of KBOO. Here's your special invitation. This is really all about you. Let's make it a community effort. With you, as they say, we can knock this ball right out of the stadium.